This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Marjorie Cohn joins us to discuss a recent case filed in the International Court of Justice alleging that Israel's military campaign in Gaza amounts to genocide.
In its 84-page application, South Africa makes a very well-documented case that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza.
With your past interview with John Pilger, in memory of his recent passing on December 30th, 2023, John was known by many as a giant in journalism and an inspiration to many journalists, including all of us here at Law and Disorder. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
Since Hamas killed 1,200 Israelis on October 7th, Israel has launched a full-scale genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza. As of this broadcast, Israeli forces have killed at least 22,100 Gazans, about 9,100 of whom are children. At least 57,000 persons have been wounded, and at least 7,000 reported missing. Untold numbers of people are trapped beneath the rubble. Israel has expelled and forcibly displaced more than 85% of Gaza's population from their homes and has cut off their access to food, water, fuel, and electricity. Although the International Criminal Court, or ICC, has been investigating what it refers to as the, quote, situation in the state of Palestine for nearly 3 years, calls for prosecution of Israeli officials have been ignored. This blind eye comes as the chief prosecutor of the ICC demonstrates blatant bias in favor of Israel. The ICC's Rome Statute provides for the prosecution of individuals who commit or aid and abet the commission of genocide. By contrast, the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, or World Court, the judicial arm of the United Nations system, resolves disputes between countries. All the 153 countries that have ratified the 1948 Genocide Convention have a duty to prevent and punish genocide, and they can submit the issue of Israel's genocide to the ICJ. On December 29th, South Africa launched a well-documented case at the ICJ, alleging that Israel's military campaign in Gaza amounts to genocide. South Africa is asking the court to order provisional measures to, quote, protect against further severe and irreparable harm to the rights of the Palestinian people under the Genocide Convention. It also asks the court to, quote, ensure Israel's compliance with its obligations under the Genocide Convention not to engage in genocide and to prevent and punish genocide. A hearing at the ICJ on South Africa's application is scheduled for January 11th and January 12th. Other parties to the Genocide Convention are being approached to join South Africa's petition. Today I interview fellow Law and Disorder co-host Marjorie Cohn, who is Dean of the People's Academy of International Law and is a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. She's professor of law emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. Marjorie has written extensively about the Israeli genocide in Gaza for Truthout. Marjorie, welcome to the interview chair on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Heidi.
What is the definition of genocide in the Genocide Convention?
It is the commission of any of the following acts when committed with the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. And those acts can include killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group.
Can you please summarize the charges that South Africa has made against Israel and the evidence it has cited in its submission to the ICJ?
Well, according to South Africa's application to the ICJ, it alleges acts and omissions by Israel are genocidal in character because they are committed with the requisite specific intent to destroy Palestinians in Gaza as part of the broader Palestinian national, racial, and ethnical group, and the conduct of Israel through its state organs, agents, and other persons and entities acting on its instructions or under its direction, control, or influence in relation to Palestinians in Gaza is in violation of its obligations under the Genocide Convention. Now, the petition, South Africa's petition, lists 8 different sections of evidence, and I'm just going to briefly summarize them to support their petition in the ICJ. First, killing Palestinians in Gaza, 70% of them women and children. And at the time the application was filed by South Africa, the tally was more than 21,110 Palestinians killed. And now it's over 22,000 as we're broadcasting, and including some summary executions. Number 2, causing serious mental and bodily harm to Palestinians in Gaza, including through maiming, psychological trauma, and inhuman and degrading treatment. 3, causing the forced evacuation and displacement of about 85% of Palestinians in Gaza, including children, the elderly and infirm, the sick and the wounded, and causing the large-scale destruction of Palestinian homes, villages, refugee camps, towns, and entire areas in Gaza, precluding the return of a significant proportion of the Palestinian people to their homes. 4, causing widespread hunger, dehydration, and starvation to besieged Palestinians in Gaza by impeding sufficient humanitarian assistance, cutting off water, food, fuel, and electricity, and the destruction of bakeries, mills, agricultural lands, and other methods of production and sustenance. Number 5, failing to provide and restricting the provision of adequate shelter, clothes, hygiene, or sanitation to Palestinians in Gaza, including the 1.9 million internally displaced people compelled by Israel to live in dangerous situations of squalor, alongside the routine targeting and destruction of places of shelter and the killing and wounding of those sheltering, including women, children, the disabled, and the elderly. Number 6, failing to provide for or to ensure the provision of the medical needs of Palestinians in Gaza, including needs created by other genocidal acts causing serious bodily harm, and including by directly attacking Palestinian hospitals, ambulances, and other healthcare facilities in Gaza, killing Palestinian doctors, medics, and nurses, including the most qualified medics in Gaza, and destroying and disabling Gaza's medical system. Number 7, destroying Palestinian life in Gaza by destroying Gaza's universities, schools, courts, public buildings, public records, stores, libraries, churches, mosques, roads, infrastructure, utilities, and other facilities necessary to sustain life, and killing entire family groups, erasing entire oral histories in Gaza, and the killing of prominent and distinguished members of society. And number 8, imposing measures intended to prevent Palestinian births in Gaza through the reproductive violence inflicted on Palestinian women, newborn babies, infants, and children.
That is mind-boggling indeed. Marjorie, what message does the bringing of this case send in the context of growing international calls for Israel to stop its genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Well, as you know, Heidi, millions of people have taken to the streets around the world demanding an end to the genocide. Countries have filed complaints in the International Criminal Court, which, as you said in your introduction, has fallen on deaf ears because of the bias of the prosecutor. And people are mobilizing to urge other parties to the Genocide Convention to join in South Africa's lawsuit. I know we're going to be talking about that. By the way, Israel and the United States are very threatened by South Africa's lawsuit.
Now, what specific provisional measures does South Africa seek from the ICJ?
South Africa is asking the court to order Israel to immediately suspend its military operations in and against Gaza and to cease and desist from killing and causing serious bodily or mental harm to Palestinians or inflicting conditions of life to destroy their group in whole or in part, and to stop these measures to prevent births. South Africa wants the ICJ to order that Israel stop expelling and forcibly displacing Palestinians and depriving them of food, water, fuel, medical supplies and assistance, and humanitarian aid.
Marjorie, what standard does the ICJ use to decide whether to impose provisional measures? Is it necessary for South Africa to prove that all of its charges are true in order to get provisional measures?
No, this is a preliminary stage. Provisional measures are like an injunction. And at this stage, the court is not called upon to determine definitively whether the rights that South Africa seeks to protect actually exist. In other words, the right against genocide. The court only needs to decide whether it's satisfied that the rights asserted by South Africa on the legal merits and for which it is seeking protection are at least plausible.
I understand there's a newly formed international coalition to stop genocide in Palestine that's calling on other countries that have ratified the Genocide Convention to intervene in South Africa's application to the ICJ. Can you talk about this a bit?
Yes, this is a coalition of nearly 250 organizations from around the world, including the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, the National Lawyers Guild, Veterans for Peace, Progressive International, Black Alliance for Peace, Popular Resistance, Code Pink, and there are organizations from the following countries: Colombia, Brazil, Venezuela, Cuba, Ecuador, Spain, Argentina, Paraguay, Haiti, Pakistan, Puerto Rico, Switzerland, Mexico, Chile, and Tunisia. This coalition is urging countries that are parties to the Genocide Convention, in other words, that have not just signed but ratified the Genocide Convention and are therefore bound by the obligations in it, to support South Africa's complaint by filing declarations of intervention. They can be filed before or after the hearing in the ICJ, which is now scheduled to take place on January 11th and 12th.
Marjorie, if other parties to the Genocide Convention do join South Africa's case against Israel, what effect is that likely to have on the ICJ?
Well, declarations of intervention in support of South Africa's invocation of the Genocide Convention against Israel will increase the likelihood that a positive finding of the crime of genocide will be enforced by the United Nations such that actions will be taken to end all acts of genocide and those who are responsible for the acts will be held accountable.
How significant is it that the first country to sue Israel in the ICJ was South Africa?
It's very significant, Heidi. In 1990, Nelson Mandela said that Palestinians like ourselves are fighting for the right of self-determination. And by the way, on December 22nd, the General Assembly passed a resolution supporting the Palestinians' right to self-determination, and the vote was 172 countries in favor, four countries opposed, and of course, the U.S. and Israel were two of those four. The petition that South Africa filed in the ICJ talks about apartheid in South Africa and apartheid in Palestine and draws parallels. They say the institutionalized regime of discriminatory laws, policies, and practices applied by Israel subjects Palestinians to what constitutes an apartheid regime. And they talk about Palestinians in the West Bank being contained behind a segregating wall, subject to discriminatory land zoning and planning policies, punitive and administrative house demolitions. They talk about routine violent Israeli raids on their homes, arbitrary arrests, and indefinitely renewable administrative detention, in other words, internment without trial. They discuss the dual legal system where Palestinians are tried under Israeli military law in Israeli military courts without basic protections of international humanitarian and human rights laws, while Israeli settlers living in the same territory are subject to a different legal regime. They're tried in Israeli civilian courts with full due process. And then the application that South Africa filed in the ICJ lists the three pillars of apartheid in South Africa that are all practiced by Israel in the occupied Palestinian territories. First, the demarcation of the population of South Africa into racial groups with superior rights, privileges, and services being accorded to one group. Second, the segregation of the population into different geographic areas, which were allocated by law to different racial groups, and the restriction of passage by members of any group into the area allocated to the other groups. And third, the imposition of a matrix of draconian security laws and policies employed to suppress any opposition to the regime and to reinforce the system of racial domination by providing for administrative detention, torture, censorship, banning, and assassination.
If the ICJ makes a finding that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza, what effect will that have on the investigation that's now pending in the ICC, or the International Criminal Court?
If the ICJ makes a finding that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza, that is conclusively proved for the ICC. The ICC, the International Criminal Court, does not have to consider evidence on that issue and decide whether or not Israel's committing genocide. The ICC would only need to decide whom to prosecute. And a finding of genocide in the ICJ will put pressure on the prosecutor of the ICC and perhaps even give him some political cover when the United States, which puts tremendous pressure on the ICC, complains. So it could have a significant effect on charges being brought against Israeli officials and leaders in the ICC, as well as U.S. leaders for aiding and abetting the genocide. And the Center for Constitutional Rights recently filed a lawsuit in federal court in the United States on behalf of Palestinian human rights organizations, Palestinians, and Palestinian Americans against Joe Biden, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin for complicity in genocide and failing to prevent genocide. And that's pending.
Yes, and we're going to continue covering that. Marjorie, as I think our listeners know, Israel customarily rejects international condemnation of its actions in the United Nations. How has Israel reacted to South Africa's submission against it in the ICJ?
Not well. They're very threatened by it. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's spokesperson, Elon Levy, promised that Israel would contest South Africa's application and called the claim of genocide anti-Semitic and blood libel. Now, blood libel, which was also raised by Israeli Foreign Affairs spokesperson Lior Hayat, is an anti-Semitic allegation that falsely claims that Jews ritually sacrifice Christian children. It's unrelated to Israel being criticized for killing Palestinian citizens. And Levy also said that Hamas is hell-bent on the genocide of the Jews and sacrificing its own civilians for that cause. So here is Israel complaining that Hamas wants genocide of the Jews, which is, you know, astounding. Also, Levy says, Israel emphatically condemns South Africa's decision to play advocate for the devil and to make itself criminally complicit with the perpetrators of the October 7th massacre. Now, keep in mind, Heidi, that in its 84-page application in the ICJ, South Africa does condemn the attacks against civilians by Hamas on October 7th. But here is Israel pulling out the anti-Semitism card, and they have said that they want Alan Dershowitz to represent them at the ICJ. That should be interesting. Alan Dershowitz is a virulently pro-Zionist, anti-Palestinian lawyer who has been associated with Jeffrey Epstein and a number of nefarious things lately, and he doesn't know anything about international law, international human rights, or humanitarian law, so we'll see what happens there.
Mm. Okay. Marjorie, the first hearing in the ICJ is going to take place on January 11th and 12th, and by the time some of our audience members are listening to this, they may be underway. When can we expect the court to issue a ruling on South Africa's request for provisional measures? And how long do you think the case will last?
Well, an average ICJ case from start to finish can last several years. It was nearly 15 years from when Bosnia first filed a case against Serbia in 1993 to the issuance of a final judgment on the merits in 2007. However, a case can have an immediate impact. The filing of a case in the ICJ sends a strong message to Israel that the international community will not tolerate its actions and seek to hold it accountable. Now, provisional measures can be issued quickly. In the Bosnian case, the ICJ issued them 19 days after the case was initiated, and provisional measures are binding on the party against whom they're ordered, and compliance with them can be monitored by both the ICJ and the Security Council. So the public hearing starts January 11th and 12th. We could see a ruling on provisional measures as soon as a week after, although the ruling on the merits may take several years.
That's heartening. And on that note, what can our listeners do to encourage other parties to the Genocide Convention to sign on to South Africa's genocide case?
There are petitions at Roots Action and Code Pink that people can sign. There are thousands of people who have signed these petitions that shows real support for joining South Africa's case in the ICJ and will not escape attention of other countries which are being approached now to join South Africa's petition or file their own petitions in the ICJ.
Marjorie, thank you so much for this. It's unfolding hopefully rapidly and may signal, I hope, a sea change in some current affairs. How can our listeners follow your work?
Yes, well, I write for truthout.org, and my column is called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. Also, my work is collected at my own website, marjoriecohn.com.
Marjorie, thank you again for joining us from the guest seat on Law and Disorder, and we will talk again soon.
My pleasure, Heidi. Thanks so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
We go now to hear a past interview with John Pilger in memory of his recent passing on December 30th, 2023. Born in Australia in 1939, John was known by many as a giant in journalism and an inspiration to many journalists, including all of us here at Law and Disorder. John was a staunch supporter of Julian Assange and his case. Let's go now to hear a prior interview with John about the film titled The Coming War on China.
Today we speak with 83-year-old renowned journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker John Pilger from his home in Australia about his most recent article, The Coming War with China. Is China a threat? Is the fear that is being stirred up about China legitimate? China has the second largest economy in the world. It will soon be the first. In response to China's commercial threat, the United States has responded militarily by surrounding the Chinese industrial heartland with 400 bases in what has been called a noose. The U.S. has some 1,100 bases around the world, while China has 6. President Obama initiated a multi-trillion dollar vast nuclear buildup. This was coordinated with what he termed a, quote, pivot towards Asia. Most of the U.S. Navy now patrols the waters off of China. Tensions have been exacerbated with respect to who governs Taiwan. The U.S. government has shored up its military alliances with China's neighboring countries, such as South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, and Australia. And the U.S. is selling billions of dollars worth of nuclear submarines to Australia. We in the U.S. live in a country whose government has been in a perpetual war the last 3/4 of a century, except with a brief interlude after its 20-year-old war in Vietnam ended in defeat. 3 million Vietnamese people died in that war. As a young reporter, John Pilger covered that war and understood that it was based on the lie that Lyndon Johnson told, falsely stating that the North Vietnamese had attacked an American ship in the Gulf of Tonkin. Another 1 million people died in the Iraq War. That war was based on the now well-known lie that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction that he was going to use against the U.S., and that he was responsible for the 9/11 attacks. A similar campaign of fear-mongering is going on now about China. The major news outlets parrot the government's fact-free line that China is our enemy. In his article, The Coming War with China, John Pilger wrote, quote, a U.S. war against China beckons, and we have a responsibility to speak out. We know what is coming. Silence must be broken, end quote. John Pilger, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's very good to be on the program. Thank you, and looking forward to it very much.
Thank you. Well, in your recent article, The Coming War with China, you wrote with alarming passion about what is developing. Please tell us about this.
Well, I made a film about 4 or 5 years ago called that The Coming War on China. On China, by the way, because it's very much what is happening these days is provocation of China. The surrounding of the eastern seaboard of China with U.S. bases. And I investigated this, and it went into a film. And I've since been writing about it since, because the whole geopolitical atmosphere dominated by the United States is about the potential of a war with China, which, when you think about it, is absurd. China is not our enemy. It's never been our enemy. It shows no sign of being our enemy. And yet, where the United States is building up its so-called allies for a war with China, presumably it will be a very provocative war with China. In other words, an invasion of some description. I find all this quite, although I've been to China and I've seen the bases and that I've seen the evidence, but I find all this almost unreal because there is, as I say, it's all unnecessary. But it's very much the main foreign policy thrust of the United States. Russia, I suppose, is number two, but certainly China is number one. And down here in Australia, which is an American vassal, they used to call it a 51st state, but it's, I don't think it really has that authority these days. It does what it's told. We have many U.S. bases, and the U.S. and Australia and the United Kingdom are about to conclude a big anti-China deal, which will involve nuclear submarines and, in other words, more provocation of a country that is our greatest trading partner. That's the strange irony in all of this. The greatest trading partner of many countries, because that's what basically China is interested in, is interested in trade, making things, and making money, ironically.
John Pilger, please talk about how fear-mongering was used to rally the American people's support for wars in Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Ukraine, and now China.
Fear-mongering. Yeah, but even that, you see, how could the United States be frightened of the world's poorest country, Afghanistan? I think it's worth asking these questions. The Vietnam thing was based again on China, that Vietnam would be one of the communist dominoes that would fall, said the propaganda at the time, allowing the great yellow peril of China to sweep down and take over Asia. Well, that's Asia. I mean, the United States is still a long way from Asia. The United States, I don't think it cares about whether the American population has been subjected to any fear-mongering. I think it just goes ahead, and it has since 1945, and takes over governments, attacks countries, destroys democracies, vulnerable democracies. It was doing that in Latin America for a very long time, and then after the Second World War, that policy became a world policy. From the time of the Korean War on, the Vietnam War was part of that, and the fear was that communism would take over the world. Well, communism didn't take over the world, and many of the communist countries are no longer communist countries. So none of it makes sense, and I think that's very important, that in 2023 we're looking at something that should be seen from the perspective of today. And I said I used that word absurd because seen from a distance, it is absurd. Many in the world, particularly in what used to be called the Third World, that is the Global South, whatever you wish to call it, are waking up to that. But all this is, in my lifetime, has been about the United States dominating world affairs. That's over. And that's what we're witnessing. It's not only over, it's over disastrously. They were driven out of Afghanistan, driven out of Vietnam, and other countries have asserted themselves. That's how the world is changing. It's a very dramatic change today. It's a change of, I think it's a change of attitude as much as anything.
Mm-hmm. And if I can interject for a moment, I know that throughout your career, you've been very outspoken and believe that we all have a duty to speak out against wars, and especially like the ones that we're seeing. As far as Iraq, what do you think would have been the likely results if, in Iraq, more journalists and cultural figures had spoken out against the war before it started?
The media has always been an extension of the established order. There may be a lot of myths about free media and constitutional rights and all that stuff. But when it comes down to it, the media is owned by big conglomerates whose politics are decidedly conservative, reactionary. So the media, I think that's important, because even these days people are still keep asking the question, why doesn't the media do something? Well, they should stop asking the question and look at the media for what it is. Now, there are exceptions, as I say, to this. Some journalists have asked questions, and those who ask questions today pay a price. I can think of two. One is the great American investigative journalist, Seymour Hersh, who has difficulty publishing his work anywhere now in the United States and has to self-publish. And of course, the second is Julian Assange. Julian Assange has spent the last 4 years in Belmarsh prison and waiting extradition on concocted charges in the United States, basically to shut him up, to close down WikiLeaks, which did a job of journalism. Both those journalists were warning the public. They were doing a basic job of journalism. They were warning the public of what they had found out, what they had investigated and found out. So in other words, these days it's very dangerous to go against power in the United States as it seeks to restore its position, its dominance.
John Pilger, talk about Obama, please. The, quote, pivot towards Asia that he announced and the nuclear buildup that he initiated. Does he deserve the adulation he still gets? Isn't it ironic that he won the Nobel Peace Prize?
You've almost got everything in Obama, because you've got the power of public relations. Obama was unique in that he was the first black president in the land of slavery. Right, once you've said that, that's the end of his uniqueness, because from that point on, he's the same and probably marginally worse than any other modern president. Obama was the great warmonger. He left office having with something like 7 wars, most of them in the Middle East, on the go. He was even given the Nobel Peace Prize. And I remember in 2009, Obama stood in the center of Prague in Czechoslovakia and made a very emotional speech of to make the world nuclear free. But and just as he was speaking, his administration was planning the greatest production of nuclear warheads under any president. So if you want hypocrisy, if you want the reverse of the truth, if you want the truth behind the facade of what I would call PR, propaganda, then you go to Obama under politics. He is perfection in that, because almost everything he appeared to be, he wasn't.
Well, let's talk also about China again. I did have a question about the Belt and Road Initiative. What is the Belt and Road Initiative? What does China hope to gain by this?
The Belt and Road Initiative is basically a development plan. It's a development plan of epic proportions. It is to open up Eurasia, that vast expanse behind, if you like, quote-unquote, behind China, So all the way across to Europe from China, through hundreds of countries. One of the main reasons for it, as far as the Chinese are concerned, is not to be dependent on the oceans for its trade, for its lifelines, its lifeblood. So everything can be developed and go over land. So what we've seen already is the first freight trains from Beijing to Europe, to London, to Berlin. And developing that vast expanse has meant China offering development plans to countries that were quite underdeveloped, both in their port systems and airports and their factories, their infrastructure. So it's the development of half the world. I don't know if it is half the world, but it must be something approaching that. It's an extraordinary project, and it's forging ahead with, I mentioned, railways, high-speed railways that go for several thousand miles, you know, with trains traveling at 200 and 300 miles an hour. That's already a reality. China's building of high-speed rail networks, both for the movement of people and trade, has been the greatest spending of the greatest development of railways in its history. It's one of the many important things that we hear very little about in the West. But of course, to those who want to go to war with China, the Belt and Road is seen as China developing itself into a very powerful, aggressive country. It's not like that at all. It certainly will, the inevitable will happen. China will be the most economically powerful country. It almost is already that we've ever known. And that the Belt and Road is linking China with the great expanse of Eurasia and then all the way on to Europe itself. It's what the early travelers of the Silk Road travelers, the Marco Polos, and the explorers used to dream of. They used to call it the World Island of Eurasia. And if you look at a map of the world from the top of it, you see it's not quite as we imagine. There is this huge area between China, Russia, and Europe, and that's what's being developed now. It's the greatest development project I understand in history. It's about trade.
Well, Joe Biden was about to visit Australia. Why has your prime minister failed to vigorously demand that the U.S. release your friend, the great journalist Julian Assange, who has been in prison, as you mentioned?
And I think it's a long. I think, Maria, I think it's a long way. Joe Biden would get jet lag. Anybody who comes, from the United States to Australia. I used to report the airport here, and I used to watch movie stars come over from the United States and fall out of the aircraft, absolutely comatose with jet lag. I'm not sure Joe would survive that trip. Just my own view. But no, I'm being flippant. It's not the first time a presidential trip to Australia has been cancelled. Obama was coming here 3 or 4 times before he finally made it. Australia does what it's told. It's part of the U.S. empire. It doesn't need the coercion of a U.S. president visiting. This one was certainly an important one because Biden was going to announce that they'd settled all their differences and that such as they were and that there was now a great united front against China. It was a big anti-China trip. So we've been spared that. I mean, he was going to other places too on the way back. When you go to Australia, you go to the end of the world, so you can stop over a lot of places. And from here, he was going to the island state of Papua New Guinea, which the U.S. has recently bribed to allow the Pentagon to take over many of the ports and airports in that country, again to satisfy this strategic front against China. And I think he was stopping at some of the Pacific islands on the way, that all of these have, of course, U.S. bases. So it was really the emperor coming to the vast nether regions of the world down here in the end of the Pacific, giving us the favor of his presence. But alas, we're not going to see him.
John Pilger, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our allotted time. But before we have to let you go, I wanted to ask you, and before I ask you for your final thoughts, I wanted to ask you, because I thought it would be enlightening and helpful to our listeners, to ask you, what do you read regularly, and what do you read to keep yourself informed?
What do I read leisurely? I read fiction. John Grisham. I'm a great admirer of John Grisham. In fact, if you want a whole program on John Grisham, I could do one. I don't like a lot of introspective fiction, but I pushed myself away from nonfiction in the last quite a few years. So it's a good question, because I think that keeps us sane, what we're reading, actually.
John Pilger, can you give us your final thoughts, please?
My final thought, did you say?
Yes.
Sounds like I'm about to expire on your program.
No.
What? I'm sorry, I didn't. You and I have had a difficulty with this. What was the question? Oh, it was a final thought. Okay. Look, I'm not sure I have many final thoughts, but I would think there was a wonderful Irish journalist called Claude Coben who once said, "Never believe anything until it's officially denied." That's a good thought. I don't know whether it's the final thought, but the thought that I would leave your listeners with is, be skeptical. Be skeptical, no matter what myths you've taken on board yourself, but just be skeptical when anybody in power tells you something. Democracies these days just simply don't work, because democracies go ahead and do things that are detrimental to the majority of their people. Otherwise they'd work. I think it is about speaking up and making your voice heard, making yourself heard in a democracy is the most crucial thing of all. I mean, there's a whole history of ideas of that in the United States. We've just got to start doing it.
With that, I want to thank you sincerely, John. It's been really terrific to have you on Law & Disorder, and you take it easy.
All right. Good to be on.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
like to send a big thanks to the following stations that are now airing Law and Disorder. KWSI, 100.3 FM, Grand Junction, Colorado. KBOG, 97.9 FM, in Brandon, Oregon. WHMI, 93.5 FM, Livingston County, Michigan. WBDY, 99.5 FM, in Binghamton, New York. KRJF, 92.3 FM, Santa Rosa, California. WXOJ, Valley Free Radio in Northampton, Maine. And WEFR, 1700 AM, West End Fairmont Radio in Fairmont, West Virginia. And for other stations who may be airing Law and Disorder, please let us know so that we can thank you and that we can include you on our website.